You might have heard the term POC before, but if you haven't, POC stands for Person of Color. Its popularity mostly comes from the United States, where it's used to differentiate minorities from white people. But in recent years, POC has become dated in many circles. The sentiment is that the term glosses over the main group of marginalized people in America, black people. And from that, the term BIPOC was born. BIPOC stands for Black, Indigenous, and People of Color. Some think that these terms are helpful, and others feel that they're pointless and not direct enough. But these are mostly American debates. If you're in Sweden, there's really no difference between POC or BIPOC, because here we're all seen as other. Other as in different. Being seen as other is a unique space to live in, and it subconsciously reminds other non-white groups living in Sweden that you'll never fully be one of us. It wasn't always easy growing up living with that stamp, but over the years, that branding has become a sense of pride. It's a part of our culture. And here we are, two black men proudly representing the other in Sweden. Myself, Jason Diakite, and my fellow Swede in Harlem, NY, Chef Marcus Samuelson. On this week's episode of This Moment, you're in for a real treat. We're going to talk to one of the most distinguished voices and minds in Sweden and the world, Mr. Jonas Hassan-Khemiri. Jonas is a young, accomplished author, playwright, activist, hip-hop fan, father of two, and part of that other as well. So join us as we chat with him about his story creation process, his experiences being seen as different growing up, and much, much more. This one is going to be amazing, people. Starting in 3, 2, 1.
We're so excited to have you, Jonas. So, yeah, man, how you been? How are you holding up with all these, like, you know, this time, this moment that we're in?
The year has been strange as for me as for everyone, but I have no reason to complain. We have been healthy. I had this kind of weird year where we had me and my family, my wife and my two kids, had kind of been in the middle of maybe moving to the States because I had received like a scholarship to do a research project in New York. So we spent the spring kind of, you know, getting ready, packing our bags, unpacking our bags, packing our bags, unpacking our bags. And ultimately, you know, of course, like we're right now, we're back. We never left and we're in Stockholm at the moment.
You have unpacked your bags now.
We finally unpacked the bags and we realized that there was no way for us to come this year, hopefully next year. But, you know, like my everyday life has been, I'm in the luxury position of having, you know, the schools have been open in Sweden. I have dropped my kids off to school. I walk like 20 minutes to a small studio where I do my writing. Then I walk back. There have been like some, you know, plays that I've written that have been postponed. There has been like a book tour in the US that was canceled. But like all in all, we're just in this strange time. There are so many people who are much more affected. So I'm just like happy to be around and that we are healthy at the moment.
Can I ask you, Jonas, just as, you know, writing rap lyrics, I'm usually doing that in a setting with at least one or two other people, like in a studio setting. The writing process, of course, is much shorter than writing books or plays or even poetry. But I imagine your writing process, obviously, is one of that's done in solitude. Well, it's a twofold question that I want to ask you. One, how do you structure your life so you give yourself that solitude where you actually have time to sit and go inward and write without being interrupted by your phone or by yourself, your own distractions of wanting to go out and drink coffee with your friends instead of sitting and writing? And the second part of the question being a world on lockdown, has it really been very different? Because I'm thinking in a way that you spend all this time naturally in solitude because as a writer, that's what you have to do.
No, the thing is, when I was a younger writer, I think I thought I had the capacity to kind of work, travel, do lectures and write at the same time. For a few years, I couldn't really create anything because I hadn't found a way to kind of, you know, like find enough focus. So what I normally do now is like I say no to everything, and I have like specific writing periods where it's just me going to my small studio. I have like a crappy internet there, or basically like no internet. That's a key for me, because I'm like, you know, it's so easy to just like start Googling cat videos. Like, my thing is, you know, speaking about rapping, it's like my kind of, you know, guilty pleasure is like Googling rappers in the studio when they first hear the rhyme that we know that they will be spitting on, that kind of thing. I can spend like endless hours of watching that. But in a way, it's the same thing that you're asking me about, because what I'm watching then on YouTube is when nothing becomes something. You know, you see Jay-Z in the studio, nothing is...
He's listening to, endless Dirt Timberland Off Your Shoulder beats. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, you see the magic, like you see his face changing, and we see that something is about to appear. You know, the lyrics are not written, the song has not been created, but we see that moment of, you know, the kind of the switch. And for me as a writer, I've realized that I need quite a lot of time alone in solitude for that thing to happen. And the main mystery for me is like, I don't know what it is. Like, I don't know what create when nothing becomes something. But I know that for me, isolation is one thing. Time is one thing. What I do is my office is just like, if I can't write, I have like a soft ball that I throw against the wall. But the big thing is for me to go there and not have coffee with friends during those periods. Yeah.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When did Jonas know, like, I'm going out in the world here and I'm going to become a writer? Which I think it's magical with the two of you, right? You both come from immigrant background, living in Sweden, and so much about our upbringing is to become normal, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And although you realize every day you're told that you're not normal, you question, are you Swedish? Are you, how much Swedish are you? Mm-hmm. There is a local conversation in Sweden about who is Swedish, authorship of who has the authorship of that. And then on top of that, both of you go out on a limb here, because writing, there is, you know, like, you know what? I can do this, you know, and I can write, I can master this, and I belong in this world. How was that for you?
Mm. I think it started just by like a deep sense of meaninglessness, like a deep sense of that life. Not that I was especially sad as a kid, but just this feeling that whatever I did, I had a hard time understanding why it was worth something in the long run. That sounds super depressing, but I remember as a kid, you know, like eating an ice cream and feeling like, so this was the ice cream, but now it's gone. And, you know, like there's this feeling that everything was so... that everything kind of withered away. And when I discovered books and writing, and especially reading first, I had this feeling, well, this will actually be around longer than we will. And that is not to say, like, I didn't get into writing. I started reading comics. And just like, it was not, you know, as a writer, you often want to say, well, you know, I started reading Proust when I was 12 and blah, 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 blah. But that was not, I read like Lucky Luke, but Lucky Luke was around, you know, and I shut the book and I went back and Lucky Luke was still there and he was still as amazing. And, you know, he was faster than his shadow. Like all these, I was really fascinated by stories. I have like a diary entry from when I was 15, when I write about kind of, I write like in Swedish, one day it would be great to write a book about like a half North African kid who would grow up. Like I basically plotted out what, you know, 8 years later would become my first novel. But the strongest feeling was that writing gave me a sense of kind of stability. So everything was kind of shaking a little bit. And in my family structure, there were also like important people who came and went from time to time. But the thing that was always stable were kind of the words, the writing, the act of writing things down gave some kind of sense of stability.
Jonas, what you did to me was that, you know, I became a rapper. I was just like, well, we all three of us were, I was just enchanted by hip hop culture. But to me, I felt an automatic sense of belonging in hip hop, and hip hop was its own world, especially seen in a Swedish context in the late 80s and early 90s. Like basically on the surface, hip hop didn't exist. So it was this like secret, it was like being a Freemason or something, because there were only, you know, I could tell from the 10 other people in the small town of Lund where I grew up, like I could tell how they were dressed, that they also were a part of this secret cult. So allowing myself as a 14, 15, 16-year-old to enter that world was like, I just did it. I didn't feel like there were no structures or pressures to stop me from being a rapper. I became a rapper when I started saying that I was a rapper, even before I actually had the ability and skills. But when you released your book, 2003, your debut book, Et Aga Rött, the title, you were like, what, 26, 20, 25? 24 years old. Yeah. And I was like, for me, it was like, wow, I didn't know that we could write books. And when I say we, is that to me, I didn't know who you were. I just saw your name and knew that he's one of us, right? And the title being Et Aga Rött, which was also the kind of the sub name of a very famous and very respected rapper called Ayu, who called himself Ayu Et Aga Rött. I was just like, it was like a code. I knew that you knew the same thing. It was like, I saw you wearing Timberland boots. I'm like, this is somebody who's like me and he has written a book. And I didn't know we could or were allowed to write books. Like that we were allowed to rap was fine because we built that world on our own. But like books is their world, you know? Like, how was that born in you?
Well, I think oftentimes we as creators, like the three of us, I think we can relate to this feeling that we try to create what has kind of changed us the most. There are movies that I like, there are plays that I, you know, can kind of get into. But the one form that has kind of restructured my way of thinking is books. That's the form that kind of that I hold dearest to me. I write in other forms from time to time. I write like short political texts sometimes, or used to, and I write plays as well. But the book is for me kind of precious. I can really relate to that time when hip hop was like kind of like a secret cult or something. So like me and my friend, there were no hip hop memorabilia to, you know, you couldn't find hip hop things in Stockholm at the time. So what we were basically going to like Panduro Hobby, you know, and buying like, you know, textile paint and, you know, just like trying to draw the logos from the clothes that we saw on Yo MTV Raps. But I quickly really realized that hip hop, that was not a form where I felt the most free. I was a terrible rapper, or I was trying to imitate. In the book world, I felt free. I felt that I could be a much cooler version than I actually was. You know, there was this. And I also think I grew up in a home where like there were a lot of books around. But I think also one of the main factors, there were more than one language spoken at home. My father and mother were both like playing around a lot with languages. And so that created also kind of, a curiosity. So you say, this is what it's called in French. This is what it's called in Swedish. How do you say it in Arabic? And also being constantly reminded that the only language that I felt comfortable to write in was Swedish because it was my mother's own.
Can I ask you about, allyship, right? When I was coming up, it just happened that, where I was living, there wasn't a lot of immigrants or people born foreign background. But once I started to go to school in the city and play soccer in the city, so all my friends then became what we would refer to as blatte. And there was an allyship and it was a comfort zone in that space, which today would probably be a grimier word for BIPOC. What in America, in English you would say BIPOC, right? And this term BIPOC has obviously, there's been allyship across different ethnicities forever. You think about civil rights movements that has allyship across Jewish community in many, many, many communities and so on. All my friends were from immigrant background. And it was just natural. They were not necessarily black, but everyone was from Yugoslavia or North Africa or Iran or Spain or Italy. And that is not abnormal in our world, but for an outside world. What does BIPOC and allyship look like in Scandinavian Sweden?
I had the feeling that we were kind of growing up and we were almost like, we were facing like a very old school, homogenized national self-image. So there was this kind of almost like there was no way for us to exist if we didn't find some kind of community, to form against that, the national self-image, which of course, like we all know it, like the old school blonde idea of what a Swedish person looks like. But I must say my growing up, my experience was a little bit different. Since my mother is Swedish, my father's from Tunisia, I played basketball and I hung around with people that had like parents from all over the world. I was always kind of questioning my place there. Do you know what I mean? And when I grew up, the saying was, "Adu hiya lala halab," are you, basically it means like, are you whole or are you half? And I would of course be forced to say half because my parents were from different backgrounds, blah, blah, blah. But what it gave to me, I think, was this curiosity of how these structures work, because I was oftentimes perceived as one of the light ones. When we were kind of young and we were going around the city trying to get into bars, and there was all these kind of stress. It was kind of tricky to be seen as a non-Swede and to get into even like hip hop bars. You had to kind of, talk to girls that you tried to find some girls you're going with. Like there was, and I what I'm saying is that oftentimes my experience, of course, like everyone who grows in Sweden, we have experience of like racism. But the interesting thing was also I quickly became aware of the important role that language played in the kind of inclusion-exclusion process. Do you know what I mean? I could basically see that some of my friends who didn't have Swedish as a mother tongue had a harder time getting the golden ticket of inclusion. So I think that also made me really curious about language. Like, what is it? What is it, the tongue that I have, the ability to speak properly, there's nothing in me that should give me that privilege. But apparently, the moment if, someone in a cop car stops or something, I knew that I had certain kind of words that I could kind of pull out, almost like a secret passport or get out of jail free card, that I knew that there were certain things that I could do that some of my friends couldn't. So I think that also came with a certain amount of shame, like, why am I let in and those friends are not,
You're learning that you learned from an early age that words also were connected to power, right? Because you can speak, quote unquote, properly or proper Swedish, that the power dynamic between you and the nightclub guard is going to be different than between that same nightclub host, guard, whatever, and maybe one of your friends who doesn't have the words in the same way, yeah, or between the cop and yourself. But
I find this is such, we're in such a unique time now, guys, because of we are connected. For example, SARS in Nigeria would have been just a very local conversation, but because of IG and social media, it's not anymore. This perception that that's what Sweden is versus a much more diverse country, that conversation today is much more connected. But when we were coming up, it was kind of an isolated conversation. If you lived in Sweden, you knew diversity was through and through in society, but you also knew that there was a tipping point here. I mean, Jason, you and Zlatan was really the first voices that changed. You know, I remember, for example, this is 10 years ago, that you wrote, Jason wrote an op-ed in a Swedish paper. And for me, that was like bigger than the biggest hit you ever had. But the fact that he wrote in a major newspaper for me, that was like on a higher level, because that opens doors up for other people, right? So this idea that Sweden is dealing with BIPOC, it's about owning the word, but it's the only term that I can say that I was always comfortable in that world. But just like you, Jonas, because of my name, Marcus Samuelsson, and also being adopted, you can speak, it's code switching. So I also felt sometimes that I could pull out that card, that I can navigate us as a Black kid, I can navigate us out of here, right? And it gave me a weird level of comfort. Jason, your name, you coming up, there is no hiding, and you, like, how did you deal with that?
Well, I think I had the same experience as you two, as far as my name was definitely a, when I was in school, when I was 9, 10, 11, 12, I was so ashamed over my name, you know. I remember when I told my mom that I wanted to change my name to Anthony. And, you know, my dad's born name is Robinson, but when he moved to Nigeria when he was a kid, his mother didn't want any of her four children to keep their slave names. So they were given the name Diakite by a local Malian man in Harlem, Papa Konate, who gave them that name. Like, and then since then, we've been Diakite. But for me, it was such an issue in school being, you know, like the teachers couldn't even pronounce my first name, you know, and I would always stand up or raise my hand before they had to get to struggling with the trying to pronounce the my last name. So many times I could avoid it. But other than that, and when I grew older, I definitely had the same experience that I could, I knew how to speak properly. And I was also small. I've been having to rely on two things, and that's basically my words and my speed. But I was small, but I had a big mouth. So I'd get into fights, but I was really bad in fight situations. So I got really fast, like I could run. And also in sports, I was always like more, I was better at speed than like the technical ability in like soccer, for example. Like I could run far and fast with the ball, but couldn't necessarily get it into the goal. But my way of like learning how to speak better was my way of getting the ball into the goal.
Can I ask you about navigating several spaces? You told Jason and myself a story once where your father could go into a store and be French and be connected with the store owner in one way. And then on another way, he would you be North African or from perceived as Middle Eastern. Could you talk us to us about that?
So my father was, he was a teacher of French and Arabic. He could speak Swedish both with an Arabic accent and a French accent. So basically that enabled him to kind of show me as a kid that languages have different, in a situation, French has much more power than Arabic, you know, based on, of course, like colonial past and historic atrocities. That's the case. If you go into a store speaking with a French accent, you're being perceived maybe as a tourist, maybe as a French. At the same time, he enters the same store speaking Arabic, that gives him another treatment, kind of. But I'm in this phase of like, you know, I'm kind of, you know, I'm really happy that you described me as young. Like, I have one of the rare jobs where you can be seen as young when you're turning 42. You know, that's like a strange thing of being a writer. But I'm also in this process right now where it's like kind of questioning the memories that I have of my childhood. Like that's a story that I've thought about quite a lot, you know. So that means that language, has a lot of power. In the beginning of my writing career, I played around a lot with language, trying to show how much power language has. And right now I'm trying to, you know, as creatives, you must recognize that as well. You know, we have a certain way of working. And now I'm in this phase of kind of tossing it all up in the air and doing things differently. So I'm curious to see what that will bring.
You know, what's fascinating to me when you explain that whole thing with France and sort of the Arab world, you know, I actually think the opposite. When you think about literature and you think of the Arab world, you take North Africa, you take that culture is so much older in terms of literature than France. But it's the same with in my world too. France has always been perceived as the country where all great food come from. And now in my last 10 years of cooking, you realize that Africa was there cooking for thousands and thousands of years. And we haven't really figured out. And it's, you know, when I wrote my book, The Rise, you know, you have to realize that the authorship of what comes out of Africa or the authorship that comes out of the Middle East, we always have to fight to get that into modern time, right? So, you know, you're up against modern history versus thousands of years history, right? How do you manage and how do you talk about your heritage? How does that manifest with your kids? How do you like actually, here's where we're from, here's where my grandparents are from, and how does that impact them as kids?
Well, it's been more visible because both me and my wife, we have a lot of family all over the world. So it's been it became more visible now with the whole recent COVID, the impossibility of going to visit them, basically. It's tricky. The other day, my eldest child asked me who's the most famous person in the world. I was leaning towards Jesus or like, and he was just like, I want someone who's living now, you know. And then, you know, I hated to say, you know, I didn't want to say that Trump was the most famous person, but then I couldn't really, I was maybe Ronaldo, maybe, or like, could it be Trump? And I realized that I didn't want him, I didn't want to say Trump because I think in some way Trump's ego would be really happy to hear that as well, that he is the most famous person in the world. But also I didn't want my child to realize that kind of that strategy works in some ways. Do you know what I mean? I think for them up until now, they are 5 and 8 at the moment. What they have been most curious about, that they realize that there are relatives that they can't talk to if they don't switch languages. So that has been kind of their way into it. But they have not, when I was a kid, I had the feeling that I thought about identity all the time. Like, and I don't see it in them in the same ways. Maybe they are blessed and healed.
Amazing. But is that winning? I just think, because I always think about, what does the end station look like? What does winning look like? Well, maybe that's it.
Yeah, maybe that could be it. Yeah.
This high connectivity that they're growing up with maybe makes the experience less lonely than it was for us growing up, where we were these isolated pockets and we weren't connected to so many other experiences that were going through the same thing that we were going through. If I would have known that, you know, for example, you had the same, like you in Stockholm, Jonas, and you and Marcus had the same problem that I had in Malmo getting into nightclubs. I mean, maybe it would have just been more of a comfort to know that it's not just me and my friends, like a lot of people like us actually exist here that have this culture or this necessity to maneuver in this country in this way, you know. I'm learning that now as I grow up, that with all along, there were many of us. And even though I could see other people that looked like me when I was a kid and when I was a teenager, it was just isn't that high connectivity of that, like, we are actually here. Now, in living in Sweden today, it feels like non-white Swedish people exist in this country. They write in newspapers. They, of course, participate in sports and culture, but they also have, like, regular jobs. And you can see Black people wearing suits. You know, I remember coming to New York during the summer holidays, I'd be so impressed and inspired by seeing, like, Black people in nice clothing and, like, suits and on the streets, and Black people that, like, my father didn't know, you know, because in Lund, we might meet a Black person with a suit on, but it would be somebody he knew, and it was like one or two. Or in that there actually existed many of us.
Or in my case, we had to stop for all the Black people we met in Gothenburg. And when you're 5 and 8, and you just want to go and play with your friends and your mom, my mom stopped randomly. Oh, there's a Black person there. We're going to stop and talk to him. And this poor guy was like 24 from Gambia. And he's like, hi, ma'am, how are you? Not sure why you're stopping.
When I speak to my dad too about how his experiences were coming in the living here in the early 70s, it between the lines, I can feel that it was, even though they had a group, they had a clique, but they were still so few that they, like, knew the names of literally everyone, you know. Whereas now we exist in Sweden en masse, and we're, if not always allowed to exist, we're, like, claiming our place. And I'd say, Jonas, your work and your art is a huge part of claiming and staking out a position in a world that has been considered fine culture, high culture, that has been sealed off for so long. I mean, it was sealed off to women and to certain classes of people. And then obviously after the existence of immigrants in this country, definitely to immigrants. And so you've definitely been a part of changing that dynamic in this whole country.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Your new book, The Family Clause, that came out in the States, in August, right?
Yeah.
And in Swedish it's called...
Big New York Times write-up, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, yeah. And congratulations on being nominated for the National Book Award.
Thank you so much.
Yo, that is incredible, man. I'm very proud of you, my friend.
Thank you so much.
But what I wanted to get to was the fact that, well, first of all, my daughter had just been born, I think the same year that the Swedish version of The Family Clause came out. And I was like, oh, Jonas's new book is about, you know, it says papa. And I had just become a papa myself. So I was like, I obviously have to read this. And I remember speaking to you and you were like, you know, I'll definitely like send you the book, but like, don't like read it right now. Just like enjoy where you are. And I'm like, what does he mean? Like, I want to dive into this. There might be some info in here that can be like valuable here in this new landscape that's so vast and unknown to me. I think I was able to wait for a few months, but then finally I had to dive in and read it. And there's so many things about that book I want to talk to you about. But the one thing was that as I read it, I really understood why you had told me to wait. Because there was also something that scared me so deeply. Like, first of all, it really made me think a lot about my own relationship with my father, which is something I had already been pondering for a long time while writing my own book. But even more troubling than that was thinking about my own role as a father now as reading the book, but also, you know, for the remainder of my life when I'll be a father. There's a kind of a bleakness to the father character, the man who is a father, but also a son, right? Because all the characters in the family clause, it's the sister who is a mother, and it's the father who is a grandfather. So the character that I identify as you, who has the two small kids and who's shopping, and at the same time you get to hear his thoughts. And there's just it was just so heavy reading it. How much of the family clause is you and your family, and how much of it is fiction? I mean, it's a novel, it's all fiction, but yeah.
Yeah. When I was starting out as a writer, I had this kind of defense, like speech almost. Like, I was just like continuously reminding everyone who read me, you know, I write fiction. This is, you know, this is not an autobiography. I think that was also a way for me to kind of defend my freedom. You know, like coming into writing and reading, books was the place where I felt free, and I had to continue feeling that way in order to continue writing. This is my fifth novel, and the more I write, the more I realize that, you know, things are, they have to ring true in order to come alive for me. That's how it is. That doesn't mean that everything in the book has happened the way it says in the book, but like I just have to really understand my characters in order to write them well. And in order to understand them fully, you know, people that I love turn up in the book. Things that have happened to me or people around me turn up in the book. It's about a family. It's the three main characters, the father, the son, and the sister. So it's an old father and his two kids who are now adult and they have kids of their own. And we follow this family during 10 days. And kind of the main thing is that the old father comes back to Sweden and is in great need of help because he's losing his eyesight. He has diabetes. He's super depressed. He needs help from his now adult children. And the kids are just like not willing to help him. They basically say, especially the son says, actually, I've calculated this really well. You took care of me during like 17 years. Now I have taken care of you. I've been a good son during 17 years. Now we're even. I'm not going to do this anymore. So the moment when he tries to change the family dynamics, well, as we all know, a lot of crazy things happen because like when you try to change a family, it's everyone in that family has to change. So that was kind of the starting off. I wanted to write about this family. And I, to be honest, like, I recognize all these characters and I understand all of them. I think the book started out with me writing the perspective of the son saying, it's my turn to shine. Like, now I'm going to write my perspective on this family. The weird thing about fiction is that the moment you start writing, you almost involuntarily start to understand other positions. And I started understanding the father much more than I wanted. You know, the father was just like, how should I put it? Kind of the pain of writing him and being in his body, because the father is one of those characters. So in the beginning, we realize that he knows everything and he thinks he's like smarter than 99.9% of everyone in the world. And he's just like very critical of everyone around him. And the first couple of pages writing him, you feel almost like powerful. But then after a while, you realize that to live in that kind of body, to live in that with that kind of certitude, you are also self-isolating yourself. And he is a very, very sad and lonely person. And the more I wrote him, I realized that actually, you know, the reason why he is the way he is and why the children, adult children are the way they are, it's also because they have this kind of family secret that no one wants to talk about. And that was kind of the main driving force behind the book, to write about the fact that the father has a daughter who has passed away. And I just knew that at some point that daughter would kind of enter the book. So that was how the book came to be. And oftentimes you know this, you know, as creators, the great thing when you create something is the moment when you realize that you can't really control what you're doing. So that was a moment when I wrote it. I just realized there were certain things that I wanted my characters to do that they kind of refused to do. And then I knew that the book was kind of taking off.
The theme that struck me the deepest in while reading The Family Clause was the theme of flight. And I think it's just because it made me reflect on my own on growing up here in Sweden, and that so many, to say even most of my Black and brown friends were boys and girls who didn't have dads that had stayed. Like, it was so normal that the dads had left, that was considered the norm. And it wasn't, I remember the day when I was 14 that my friend David said to me that, you know, well, Jason, you and I are different. I mean, you have a dad. And I had never really, I had reflected on it as far as, because my dad used to always remind me, he still does, that, you know, I stayed in Sweden because of you. I would never be here if it wasn't for you being here. And I don't think I was able to, in my teenage years, to really understand the gratitude to really how grateful I should be about that.
Yeah. When I was writing the book, there was this kind of curiosity where I started realizing that a lot of people around me, including myself, who had experiences of parents who, during certain periods, often like important periods, that the parents had left or not been around, when they themselves became parents, like when the kids had kids of their own, they had this really strange idea of what it meant to be a good parent. Like, they thought that in order to be a good parent, you had to be like the son in the book. He has this idea, like, a good parent is someone who's like 100% present, who never like thinks about something else, who's always in the life, like focus on his or her kids. And I think ultimately that idea becomes quite, you know, if you have one thought that you tell yourself that you're not supposed to be thinking. So the son in the book says to himself, like, I must not ever have the emotion that I want to flee. Like, that's a forbidden emotion. I will never feel that. If you have that, it almost becomes like a thought loop where you, like, he's basically thinking, I can't think it, to the point where he actually has to leave his kids in a way. Yeah, he has to do it. So I think that I was interested in kind of looking at the process of if you have an idea of how you're going to be as a parent, what happens when that collide with the reality of, you know, taking care of two crazy persons who are, you know, as kids are, really demanding. At time, you know, I love my kids, but there are moments when I just want sit at peace and read my book. Yeah, yeah. let go of my leg, yeah, and just let me read. You know, and that if I had the emotion that that would mean that I would be a terrible parent, that would also ultimately mean that I, you know, I wouldn't allow that feeling in me. So I want to voice that experience in the book, and also to, in a way, like teach myself that that emotion also has to exist. You know, that it's okay to have that emotion as well, you know, as because at the moment when we kind of tell ourselves that certain emotions are kind of forbidden, they control our lives.
One of the things that I love about your writing is that, you know, as a chef, I trained French food, but I loved street food. I loved all the food of the hawker stands in Singapore, the Turkish street food in Berlin, or so on. And you really are challenged between, am I supposed to like this food? Can I write this food into my restaurant food? But this is a stage where you're supposed to do French food. You are completely unapologetic. And I just love that. Like, because you must have also, I mean, we all grew up with, this is how we talk, or this is the street food that I love, and but that doesn't fit in the restaurant. So what was that like? And did an editor come to you and say, hey, Jonas, you have to edit this out? Or how did you work on that? Find your voice?
For every project, I've kind of been really focused on what I fear the most. So with the first book, that was really, you know, I grew up in a home where the kind of mantra was, you have to speak Swedish better than every person, always. So that's like, respect grammar. Grammar is like more important than God, you know, like. So then I released a book that was like full of curse words and like really kind of, you know, a young person who was actively trying to break down language. That was my first book. The second book, I was really fearful of other things, and that turned up in the book. And with the family clause, I think of the family clause a little bit coming full circle, because I realized that what I was fearful of was, I think I saw something in the earlier books that people were constantly leaving. Instead of like staying and being in a relationship with people, they took the easy way, like they left by, you know, imagining something, or they used their fantasies to flee. And I was curious to write something about kind of the courage of not leaving. Like, what happens if you actually stay? Because we all have this idea that it takes courage to leave, to go out into the world, to kind of discover new things. But actually, in a family structure, I don't know. Like, when I was a kid, I used to think there were a lot of kind of fathers who were not around when I grew up. And I used to think of those fathers as kind of, in some sense, free, you know, they had left their families. I don't know where they were, but they were somewhere out there. And now when I think about those dads, like there's like nothing free about them, you know, that the person who actually had the courage were the people who stayed, like these, and that was, and that's also it's so unjust in a way, because the person who leaves takes up a lot of space, you know, creates a big shadow. And the person who remains, oftentimes, as in the book, it's the mother who remains, is almost made invisible. And that's a theme that I've been seeing throughout my work, that I often write about kind of people or friends or often fathers, you know, who have disappeared. And then what happens to the people who remain? And in this last book, I instead of kind of just like letting the characters leave, I wanted to, in my mind, I think of this book as almost like an homage to everyone who stays put, you know, who doesn't leave. Yeah, who's just like realizing the how much courage it takes to stay.
Before we go, Jonas, I just wanted to ask you, what what rapper or rappers are you listening to currently, like in 2020 and now? What rap music is moving you right now?
Earlier today, I listened to the Kendrick and Busta Rhymes song.
I didn't know it had come out. Okay, I gotta blast that.
Yeah, I'm a kind of Frank Ocean and Kendrick have been like long associates of mine. I've just been like, I'm basically what I'm looking for in a book is the same thing that I'm looking for in music. Like if you're telling me a story and you value my time, and I think that's what both Frank Ocean and Kendrick Lamar managed to do. They tell a story that they show that they value my time, and they also kind of they manage to go deep into the specifics to tell something that everyone can relate to. Those are kind of like my go-to heroes at the moment in contemporary music.
It's just a privilege to hear you speak, Jonas. And
No, thank you. It was so, so loving. It's almost like a therapy session.
All right. Be well, my friends.
Cool.
All thank right. you.
Take care, everyone.
Ciao. Peace.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.